ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot.
Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. How strong was the case against Chris Bynum? I'm sure you're thinking at this point that there must be more. There must be some physical evidence, another witness, a tipster, a surveillance camera, something. But here's the crazy thing. At this point, you have heard the entirety of the state's case that convicted Chris already. That was it. In most seasons, we spend months going through all of the trial witnesses. We examine every angle of the prosecution's case. But at the Bynum trial, it seems like the state actually made real efforts to avoid putting anyone on the stand that could fall under the scrutiny of cross-examination, including the lead detective. Let me recap for you the entirety of the state's witnesses from trial. They began with family members of the victims. You'll hear those testimonies today. This was the prosecution's attempt to humanize the victims in front of the jury and officially identify them, pretty standard practice at trials. Then came Jean Eggleston, who just testified about hearing the gunshots at the park. Her testimony is 2 pages long. Then Terrell Triggs, who testified about finding the bodies at the park. 3 pages. Then came Larry Brooks, who provided the most devastating testimony against Chris. As I'm sure you remember, unlike in his initial statement to police, where he said he didn't see anyone and only heard voices that he didn't recognize, at trial he names Chris Bynum repeatedly on the stand. Then came Willie Marshall, Amp's brother, who testified about Amp calling him on the night of the murders. Then we move into law enforcement officers. Officer Dame was not called to testify. Now, this was obviously a strategic move considering he took the statement from Larry where he said he didn't recognize any voices or see anyone. There's no way the state would want him to be scrutinized under cross. So instead, we get Officer Kouros, who was the first arriving officer at the ballpark. Then Officer Trevino, the first arriving officer, along with Dame at the house. Then Theotis James. His 3-page testimony consisted of him putting Larry and the baby into the squad car at the house crime scene and going to get their grandmother. Then Dr. Kim, who briefly went over the autopsies, and then Bertosi, the crime scene investigator, who testified about all the evidence collected at the scenes, none of which pointed to Chris. Then Henry Hatch, the firearms examiner, who explained to the jury that the bullets found at both crime scenes appear to have come from the same gun, a gun that was never identified nor tied to Chris. Then Lewis Donald, who you heard from last week. His job was just to get Chris's statements in front of the jury. And that's it. The state rested after Donald's testimony. This was a quintuple homicide spread across 2 crime scenes, and the entirety of the state's case was presented in 2 days at trial. To put that into perspective, Ed 8's trial from season 2 took nearly a month, over 20 days of testimony. And that was for 1 murder at 1 crime scene. So what evidence was actually presented against Chris? Well, Larry Brooks said his name a bunch of times without any real context about how he knew it was Chris. And then Detective Donald read in his typed up statement. That is the full extent of the state's case against Chris Bynum. No murder weapon, no fingerprints, no DNA, no actual witnesses, and most importantly, no investigation. One thing that I always stress to my investigative journalism students is to always look for what's left out, what is not being said. In this case, what are we missing? We're missing any indication of tangible efforts to actually investigate this case. How did the Gary PD determine Chris was their guy? They have a so-called confession where he tells a wild story that's provably false, and a witness identification from a 12-year-old boy who told police that he had no idea who killed his family when they first spoke with him. And according to him, the only reason he named Chris is because they told him to. Did the detectives track Sheila and Liz's movements that night? Did they check to see who they may have come into contact with prior to their murders? Did they talk to anyone at the VFW to see if Chris was actually there and what time it was that he left? Did they search Chris's belongings, house, and car to look for evidence that he even owned a gun? None of these questions were answered or even presented for the jury. So what are we missing? Or more poignantly, who are we missing? Detective Gault. He was the lead investigator on the case. He was in charge of the entire investigation, and yet he is never called to the stand by the state. So we have a pretty good idea of what they're not telling us, which then begs the question, why? Why was Gault not put on the stand? If you read the other officer's testimony, then the answer, I think, becomes pretty clear. Because the state didn't want to answer hard questions about the complete lack of care or attention that was put into this investigation. Read Donald's testimony. What do you see? Anytime a tough question about the investigation is asked, his response is that he wasn't the lead investigator. He doesn't know the answers to those questions because that was Gault's responsibility. So the questions remain unanswered, and they stay that way because the person with the answers was left out of the equation. As we move throughout this season, we're going to do our best to actually answer those hard questions and make our best attempt to do what the police never did: investigate this case. In the meantime, we're going to finish up getting a full picture of the trial today. In order to do so, we're going to jump back to the beginning to the first few witnesses, family and friends of the victims, right after this break. Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Moro Casino.
America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save with customized coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Now that you've heard all of the evidence that was presented against Chris, let's go back to the very beginning of the trial. The very first witness that was put on the stand was a woman named Kathy Yost. Kathy is the aunt of both Angela and Suzanne Wallace. Her purpose on the stand was simply to identify the two female victims from the house crime scene, almost like a formality. I was hoping that having the victim's family members on the stand might lead to a little bit of insight into their victimology, but no such luck. Although we do hear a little bit about their afternoon on the day of the murders. We learned from Kathy that her sister Judy, who she was living with at the time of the trial, had three children. Angela, Suzanne, and a son named Jimmy. When I first started reading the testimony, I was curious as to why the women's mother wasn't the one to testify rather than their aunt. The answer appears to be because Kathy actually spent some time with the ladies that day. She explains in her testimony that both Angela, who she calls Renee, and Suzanne, who she calls Susie, both lived at the house on 10th Avenue. Susie had one child, 12-year-old Larry, and Renee, or Angela as we know her, had one daughter, Katrina, who was 18 months old at the time of the murders. She was the one on the couch. Kathy says that on the day of the murders, she spent most of the day with Angela and Katrina running errands. Around 3 p.m., Angela dropped Kathy off at home, and she asked to borrow Kathy's car so she could go shopping the next day. Kathy agreed, and Angela drove off, and that was the last time that she ever saw her. And this all lines up with Larry's testimony that he was walking home from school when his Aunt Angela pulled up and gave him a ride. The timing is right, and since Angela didn't own a car, it makes sense that she was driving Kathy's. Kathy's testimony is short and sweet. After identifying her two nieces and sharing the story about running errands with Angela, the prosecutor moved on to when she found out about the murders. She said that around 2 a.m., the police came to the house and broke the news to Judy, who then told Kathy what happened. The next and last time Kathy saw her nieces was at their funerals. The next witness was Lorraine Marshall, Amp's mother. She testified that she had four children, Willie, who we heard from a few weeks ago. He was in the courtroom at the time, and he was 33 years old. There was also Tara, who was 27, and Latoya, who was 19. Anthony, or Amp, was the oldest at 36 years old when he was killed. Just like with Kathy, Lorraine was also shown a photo of Amp and confirmed that it was indeed a picture of her son. Collins, the prosecutor, then asked Lorraine if Amp had any children. She starts to say that he has a 19-year-old son, but Graddick objects. That leads to a short bench conference where he explains that he doesn't want the state prejudicing the jury by sharing who Amp left behind and creating sympathy for the victims. Collins explained that she just wanted to establish that Amp wasn't Larry's father, and the judge sustained the objection, and Collins rephrased the question. Instead, she asked if Amp's son was named Larry Brooks. Lorraine says no, his son is Anthony Jeffers Jr. so she still got it in. After that, Lorraine explained how she was notified of her son's death. She said the police knocked on her door at about 4 a.m. and she didn't get up to answer it. And then, about 45 minutes later, someone called and told her that her son had been shot. And that concluded her testimony. The trial seems to be progressing just about the same way the investigation did. We get no probing questions from either attorney that might help us better understand victimology. Honestly, I can excuse these types of questions not being asked at trial. The state doesn't care, and it would be dangerous for the defense to ask a victim's mother about something like their drug use. You risk the jury turning on you. But what keeps nagging at me is what we learned in the autopsies. That all three victims at the house had smoked crack cocaine literally within a minute or two of their deaths. Amp specifically likely was in the process of smoking it when he was shot the first time. If the police had expended any amount of effort to figure out who they got their cocaine from, and more importantly, who they would regularly smoke with, I believe this case could have been easily and properly solved. The next witness was Jacqueline Yerpa. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. Her last name is spelled H-J-E-R-P-E. I believe it's Scandinavian and is pronounced, as I said, Yerpa. Jacqueline was Liz Ayer's mother. She's the grandmother that Tasha talked about in her interview with me a couple months ago. The one who was told by police that she knew what kind of person her daughter was. Also the same one who slapped said police officer. We learned through her testimony that Jacqueline had three children, James, Robert, and Liz. And just like the other witnesses, she identified a picture of Liz for the jury. Collins then asked how she was notified of Liz's death. She explained she got a phone call and then headed back to Gary from Shipshewana where she lived. She went straight to the coroner's office and Collins ended the questioning right there. Probably didn't want to get into what happened next. That's where the slap occurred. And Craddock didn't cross-examine her, and she was released from the stand. Next up was Sheila's husband, Sean Barty. His testimony was the shortest of all of them. He was asked if he was married to Sheila. He says yes. He identifies a picture of her, and then he's asked what he did when he learned about her death. He said he was in shock, and that was it. Not a single question about who Sheila was, what she was doing out with Liz that night. Nothing. Now, to be fair, I wouldn't expect those kinds of questions at trial. But the frustrating part is that we should already have those answers. Sean should have been interviewed by the police, as should have Kathy and Lorraine and Jacqueline, and Tasha for that matter. I know I'm beating a dead horse, but the complete and total lack of thoroughness in this investigation is just stunning. Not one tiny bit of effort was put into learning anything about these victims. I've literally never seen anything like this. Five victims, two crime scenes, zero physical evidence or witnesses, and these detectives didn't even do the bare minimum. I'm going to take a quick aside here and just walk through the steps that I would have taken in the initial stages of the investigation if I was in charge. First things first, I would have interviewed Larry honestly, without manipulation. No lying to him, no pushing a narrative, but get the real story about what he remembered. If what he said to Dame on the night of is accurate, then we know that we're looking for two black men. Based on the fact that there were no signs of forced entry and Larry didn't hear any commotion until the shooting started, we can assume that the victims knew their attackers. That gets confirmed later when we get the results from the tox screen. Again, we know that the three victims were smoking with their killers. Next, I would canvass the neighborhood. It sounds like Etna is a place where everyone kind of knows everyone. So, talk to the neighbors. Obviously ask if they saw anything, but also ask what they know about the comings and goings in the house. Do they know about any drug use? Do they know if there's a particular car or a person that comes by late at night often? I'd interview Kathy and Lorraine and Jacqueline and Sean and Tasha, find out who the victim's friends are. Now, these crime scenes are connected, then I think Amp is the key. Everyone knew him and seemed to like him. Find out who he hangs out with, who he smokes with, who he buys from. Then start interviewing those people. Start checking alibis. Remember, again, they were smoking with their killers at 2 a.m. This wasn't a stranger, and to me, it doesn't seem like a dealer. It seems like a friend. It's someone who stopped by earlier in the night and came back with cocaine. And while working that angle, I would start tracing Liz and Sheila's steps that night. Go to the local liquor stores and start asking around. Find out which one they went to after leaving Michelle's house. Check for surveillance footage. See who they met there. The evidence indicated Sheila ate within an hour of being killed. Find out where she ate. Who did she come into contact with? Look for crossover between that list and the list of people that are likely to go smoke with Amp and Angela and Suzanne. This fucking case is solvable. Pull Michelle Flores' phone records. Find out who called Liz that night. Also, don't forget that paper with the number on it. Now, personally, I believe that there was a paper with a number, but I do not believe that it was Chris's number. In Michelle's police statement, typed up by these same detectives, it says the number on the paper was the same number that was typed into Chris's statement. But I'm sorry, there is no way that's true. That would have been the smoking gun. No getting around it. If it existed and that's what was written on it, then that piece of paper would have been the first item of evidence entered at trial. But instead, when we get Michelle's actual words out of her mouth on the stand at trial, no number is given. No paper is presented to the jury. But she does say that the note existed. What that tells me is that there likely was a phone number or pager number written down by Liz. And the police had it and knew damn well that the number very likely belonged to the killer. And instead of following that lead, they tossed the note and coerced Chris Bynum into giving a bogus confession and closed their case. Increased their clearance rate without a shred of concern about finding actual justice for these victims.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts. So I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
The next witness to testify was, in fact, Michelle Flores. Now, we already went through her testimony very early on in the season. She told us about Sheila coming over, then Liz stopping by. Liz talked to someone on the phone, then asked Michelle to go with her to the liquor store. Michelle declined, and Sheila went with Liz instead. They left, and that was the last time she ever saw them. The note was mentioned at trial, but no specifics were given. No number, and the physical piece of paper was not put into evidence, as I mentioned, as though it never existed. What I want to conclude things with today is to read to you Michelle's police statement. It was taken in the same manner as all the others. It's typed up to look like a transcript, but it wasn't actually recorded. This is the full interview, According to the page numbers, nothing's missing, but you will notice a few places where things seem to jump around. Like Michelle's answering a question that was never asked. It's always at the top of the page. I don't know what to make of that because, again, the page numbers seem like there's nothing missing. With that being said, here's the statement. Quote, what's your true name, age, address, telephone number, and social security number? She gives all that information. Where and when were you born? She gives that information. Are you married or single? How many dependent children do you have? She says she's separated and she has five. Can you read and write the English language? Yes. Have you been advised of your rights according to the Miranda ruling? Did not answer. That's interesting. What is your occupation? Unemployed. Do you realize that this statement may be used in case of a trial? Yeah, it's okay. Why are you here at the Gary Police Department at this time? Because I think it's my girlfriends are in the paper. Please tell me what happened. In your own words, what can you tell me about this incident? They left to go meet somebody at the liquor store and never came back. I think it was this guy Chris that she had called. She beeped him and he called back and they told her to meet him at the Sporting Life Liquors. They never came back. This is one of the places where it jumps around because we go right back into Michelle with no question. Well, when I got up, sitting by the phone on the table was this number, showing this detective a page with the number 890-1277, and it says "see attached," as though the actual paper was attached to the document. Back to the transcript. And Chris underneath it. Then I pushed *69 to see what number he had called from, and it was 938-1751. See attached. Now again, showing this detective the number 890-1277 and saying this is in Liz's handwriting. I think Liz called Anthony and he gave her this beeper number down to call. She wrote this down at my house and then she beeped him and then he called back. Renee had nothing to do with it. Me and Renee were already in bed and Liz knocked on the door and asked to use the phone. And from that point on, she made a couple of phone calls and then I yelled, the phone rang. And I yelled from the bedroom, did you beep someone? And she said, yes. And then she answered the phone. Then she said, you guys want to run with me to the liquor store? I got to go to Sporting Life. And I said, no, I'm in bed and I don't feel good. I was in bed and Renee said, I'll go. Then Renee said, so I'm gone. I'll take your keys so you don't have to get up and let me back in when we get back. That was it. They left. I never heard from them again. Who is they? They were Liz and Renee. Who is Liz? Her name is Liz Daly Ayers. Her husband is a truck driver. Her husband's name is Lacey Ayers. She's about 5'7", red hair, brown eyes. She got a missing front tooth. She got a butterfly tattoo on her chest. She got a tattoo on the right calf of her leg, a heart with a dagger. It says Bloomer, B-L-O-O-M-E-R. That's about it. She's unmistakable with the tattoos and the tooth missing. Who's Renee? Sheila Renee Barty, about 5'6", 210 pounds, long brown hair, naturally curly, hazel eyes, and she has scars on her knees from knee surgery. A plain person, a housewife. Her husband's name is Sean, Sean Barty. He was here in the Gary jail. He got picked up for a DUI Tuesday 3 days ago, and they transferred him to Lake County. Renee didn't want to stay home alone, so I told her she could come stay with me because I have a telephone and Sean would call me from the jail. She stays on Melton Road in Lot 111. She lives in the same trailer park. Do you know Chris's name? No. Do you know anything about him? I just found that was the only thing on this piece of paper. The rest of it is mine. In parentheses, again referring to the page. Where is Sporting Life Liquors? It's on 20 in Gary. It's right past Clay Street. Why'd you say Renee had nothing to do with it? Renee was just going for the ride so Liz wouldn't be by herself. Do with what? I don't think she, Renee, knew who Liz was calling or who she was going to meet or anything. Were you and Renee in bed together? No, she was on the couch. Who made the phone calls? Liz. Why was she at your house? To use the phone. Did she always get phone calls at your house? No, but she uses my phone and sometimes she beeps people and they call her back. Who wanted to go to the liquor store? Liz. It says, statement, I'm going to show you some photographs. Do you recognize anyone? This is Liz. This is stated to this detective by Michelle H. Flores and Donna Vaughn, the sister of Renee Barty. So apparently Donna's in the room at this point. Back to this transcript. Is this the Liz that you were referring to during this statement? Yes. And again, this is another spot where it jumps around. The next line here, this is from Michelle. She says, from her husband. Did Liz get high? Yeah, Liz is a character. It says, statement, I'm going to show you some photographs. Do you recognize anyone? Michelle. That is Liz, referring to photo number 2, and this is Renee, referring to photo number 1. This is confirmed by M.H. Flores and Donna C. Vaughn, who is the sister of Sheila Renee Barty. Is this the lady that you're referring to as Liz and Renee? Yes. This is from the sister of Sheila, Donna Cheatham Vaughn, who also confirms the identities. Do you know why this incident occurred? Shakes head in the negative, no, I haven't got a clue. End quote. Aside from the frustration I've already expressed about the note, the part of this interview that is even more infuriating is the fact that Michelle told Moxley and Galt in this interview exactly where Liz and Sheila went when they left the house. She told them that Liz said she was going to the Sporting Life liquor store. She even told them exactly where it was at. And after reading the details in that statement, I'm even more convinced that there was, in fact, a sheet of paper with something written on it. Did you notice the little part where she said the rest of the stuff on the paper is from me? She is clearly referring to a piece of notebook paper where this was written. It did exist. Just didn't make it to trial. And even though she told them exactly where Sheila and Liz went when they left that house, they couldn't be bothered with making the trip there to even check it out. And this interview was given on the day after the murders. And I can all but guarantee you that a liquor store in the year 2000 in that neighborhood would have had surveillance cameras, almost without question. I cannot say this any more clearly. This case was solvable. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kate Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Moto Casino.
America's Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.